Welcome to this hour of We the People. I'm your host, David Whetstone, right here at WPFW Washington. We're at 89.3 FM and WPFWFM.org. Empowered strong by 50,000 watts, terrestrially. But our main empowerment comes from listeners like yourselves who choose to support us both financially and socially for more than 48 years. Our mission is jazz and justice. We seek to build a better world, one broadcast at a time. We try to serve the creativity and needs of our listening community. And I'm here to do that in this hour. If you're new to We the People, it's a news magazine that deals with the issues of history, race, politics, and culture, particularly where they intersect. In the past, folks have left us a rich legacy to work with that's very relevant to today. In the present, people are doing hard work, trying to establish justice, building better communities through various efforts, various vocations. And it's the point of this show to honor all that. This morning, we'll look at banned books. It's a problem that's still with us. The majority of book censorship attempts now originate from organized movements, pressure groups, and government entities that include elected officials, board members, and administrators have initiated 72% of the demands to censor books in schools and public libraries. Let's find out the response to this situation. To do that, our guest is Sam Helmick. Sam Helmick is the 2025-2026 American Library Association president. Helmick has served as a member on the ALA Executive Board and a past president of the Iowa Library Association. They previously served as former chair-elect on the Intellectual Freedom Roundtable and chair of the Iowa Governor's Commission of Libraries. They have served on committees for the Network of the National Library of Medicine, the Stonewall Book Awards, the ALA Policy Monitoring Committee, Young Adult Library Services Association, and the Reference and User Services Association. Helmick is also an author, consultant, and instructor for social media marketing and graphic design. It's a pleasure to have you. Good morning. Welcome.
David, it's so wonderful to be in community with you today. Thank you for inviting me to your show.
Oh, you're welcome. I guess if you've been in these United States and are of age of some sort, you kind of have a rough history of book bannings, challenge books, and we'll get to distinguish both of those terms, by the way. You're familiar with attempts of censorship, whether it starts as early as colonial New England, where as early as 1637, a pamphlet was burned and forbidden. And then later on, the pamphlet burning occurred in 1650, a forbidden book accused of political subversion in 1637, was criticizing Puritan practices, seems to be the first distinctive in the mainstream of history. And then we just go further. Harry Beecher Stowe's Uncle Tom's Cabin in 1852 is banned from southern states, of course, for obvious reasons. But probably an important touch point is the Comstock Act of 1873, which banned the mailing of obscene, lewd, and Civius material. So those are just initial touch points. I'm sure people are familiar with accusations against To Kill a Mockingbird, The Diary of Anne Frank, The Bluest Eye, Catcher in the Rye, Fahrenheit 451, The Handmaid's Tale, and so forth. But for the benefit of your expertise and the knowledge of for my listeners, what would you like to say about the start and present of banned books?
I thank you for the rich history that you're providing, because the First Amendment has always been a tool by which we have to reconcile difficult conversations. I think about the Barnett case in 1943, where parental rights ensured that students couldn't be compelled to say the Pledge of Allegiance. So compelled speech, withheld speech have always been important terms and understandings and concepts to work through. In 1982, the PICO case, which was the year that we started the American Library Association Banned Books Week, really was focused on the removal of books like Richard Wright's Black Boy, Vonnegut's Slaughterhouse-Five, and Go Ask Alice, which were materials that the very parents and teachers in that school system had read when they were children. And so it really was a reconciliation of whether we believe that we should be teaching American children what to think or how to think, and what are their rights in terms of accessing a broad form of information.
And I'm thankful that you mentioned Banned Book Week, which we're in the midst of. It's this week's, folks, as you're listening to this live broadcast. You said it was established in 1982.
That's correct.
You've had some honorary chairs. We might want to take notice of them so we can get an understanding of the effort. I believe George Takei is your present honorary chairperson.
Definitely. I had the honor of listening to George and introducing him present on his stories as a child in American concentration camps, which he has really beautifully depicted with words and graphics in his latest graphic novel. And to really reconcile with the fact that our history has always been fraught and that liberty cannot defend itself. It does require every single generation to step up and show up and speak up for their rights.
All right. And then past honorary chairs, as far as I understand it, are the really renowned and notable writer Jason Reynolds, George M. Johnson, who's still targeted with his All Boys Aren't Blue. LeVar Burton of Reading Rainbow fame, and shout out to the new transition, a new era for Reading Rainbow.
Michael Treats, yes.
A librarian.
Yes. And, a librarian, yes.
Yeah, and last but not least, I want to mention filmmaker Ava DuVernay. So people get a sense of the diversity and the plurality of support for the efforts to support the freedom to read. That's what we're talking about. I know you're going to primarily focus on the library part of things, but I also wanted to mention to listeners that PEN America documented 23,000 book bans in public schools nationwide since 2021. And so we've been seeing this upsurge. And as I said, it's a lot of the energy for this is coming from organized efforts. Can you... If you don't have any further mileposts to mention, can you just tell us how the numbers have grown, what are the efforts, and what is this organized shoulder effort to ban or challenge books?
Yes, great question, David. So I think what we've noticed through third-party studies, if you visit uniteagainstbookbans.org, the American Library Association not only has a playbook to help you defend free people reading freely and to show up for your library in these conversations and to be made aware of where these conversations are starting to take shape in the nation, in your own communities, but it will show you through third-party studies that over 72% of these challenges are coming from special interest groups that often do not live in the community that is being served by that library, and frankly often even include books that are not in the catalog of that library. So we're seeing less of a good faith effort. Libraries have always been equipped with policies, processes, and procedures to reconcile where a book lives, how it should be labeled, where it should be located, what is its purpose in the special setting, whether it's school, academic, or public, because all three libraries serve distinct functions. And we all recognize that grievancing your government is a First Amendment right. We were prepared and we have been doing this great work for decades so wonderfully together. And suddenly there's this sweeping movement to no longer trust ourselves or trust our neighbors with that autonomy to read and access information freely.
So last year, 2,452 unique titles were challenged. And I think that's the third highest number on record. But instead of letting that number hang in the distance, let's follow it step by step. First of all, in my layman mind, it's when a book is challenged, it's usually more of a direct argument over content, whereas the broader notion of banning a book is usually just more of a broad political effort, and who knows if the content is actually being challenged, examined, or interpreted. And allow me to say right now that I find librarians, like teachers, are very thoughtful about, without judging individuals, of responsible readership, of honoring the reader. And there's a strong context of understanding. We all can draw upon our grade school and elementary school and high school experiences, and whether we enjoyed the literature or not through our teachers, we can at least recognize that there was an effort of respect and context that goes along with this. I believe librarians do the same.
Absolutely, David. Whether it's your state institution, like a state library, or if you actually go to an accredited graduate school to learn process, law, First Amendment, literacy development, age-appropriate information literacy development, critical thinking, analysis. This is the work that knowledge leaders and thought partners in the library space are equipped and trained to support, whether that community is public or academic or school. And to your point, I really have appreciated the American Library Association's position on making these tools available to the broader public, too, because we recognize that libraries are reflections of the communities we serve, and that it has always been a call and response between the communities. So you're absolutely right. If somebody comes in and they talk to me like, let's talk about J.K. Rowling, right? We might be considering, hey, some of these books just thematically get a little bit heavier and darker as the protagonists age out of childhood. Do some of these belong in the children's department and some of these belong in the teens department? Another person may say, I really do not like this person for A, B, and C. I'm not sure I feel like these books should be platformed by a library. So then we have a good faith conversation about whether the presence of information is the endorsement of either the person who's written it or the ideas they're in, which according to the First Amendment, according to the Library Bill of Rights, it is not. Or we could, you know, see where it was historically banned because of its context in witchcraft and like a more conservative religious movement. And so ironically, this is a very interesting microcosm of the variety of conversations that library workers are equipped to have with their community, with their stakeholders, together through formal processes to determine what is the best next step for our community.
Yeah, and I need to say that 55% of the challenges take place engaging public libraries. That's a big hefty share. 38% come with school libraries, and then the percentages go down. Again, I want to reiterate something if I didn't make it clear earlier, and we talked about this number of concerted, organized challenges to books. So 26% come from pressure groups, and they usually have direct influence or connectivity with 10% of the elected officials of government and 36% of the board or administration representatives. So that makes your 72%, if numbers mean anything to our dear audience here. Can you say a little bit more how things play out for the for a library or librarians? I know it's not generic, each community is different, but is there a general framework that we can start thinking about this when this happens?
Definitely. I'll give an example, and I'm going to pick on Stephen King because he's a wonderful advocate for libraries as well and reading, and he was one of our ambassadors for Banned Book Week in our history. And I've had folks say, shucks, there's a lot of shelf space for Stephen King. You're giving up a lot of library real estate. What are you doing here? And we'll kind of laugh or we'll, you know, joke about James Patterson the same way. And that's actually a challenge. It's saying, hey, I'm not quite sure I like the amount of real estate you're giving an author. And so they can even be light like that. But let's say that there was like a serious concern about one of his titles. We can have a conversation. Let's listen to each other. Let's lean in. And if we don't feel satisfied by the outcome at that point, there's a reconsideration process that needs to involve our peers and the community and a full review of the title, because books deserve their day in court in their full entirety. And then those determinations are not a performance. They're a procedure. And sometimes they result in the book being, relabeled, the book sometimes being removed from its section. Sometimes it results in the book actually having extra copies purchased because its value and merit has been deemed to be so important that that is the necessary outcome according to the community. So when we talk about having like a conversation versus a challenge going through the process, that's a lot different than legislators just listing off books without really any context or legal terminology that would help us connect the dots of what's really trying to be achieved outside of a systemic erasure of some of our most marginalized groups and a chilling effect to try to teach Americans that thoughts are dangerous and that they are not to have them openly with their own free will.
Yeah, I guess the point of the banning is kind of a demand that no one gets access to a narrative. No one gets access to a book.
Or David, they try to insinuate that only folks with affluence and wealth deserve them. There is some specious argument that a ban by any other name is not as pernicious. And it's like, well, some of us can buy a $10 paperback and purchase that material. We'd have to be aware of it. So the discovery of just, the voyage of discovery, inquiry, browsing, and just kind of navigating the shelves of a public library has been something our founders thought was important in order for us to continue to try to progress as a society and to try to reserve that for an affluent class, I think suggests that this is actually two things. It is a very relevant cultural conversation that has been diminished to the term of a culture war, but it is significantly distracting us from the class war and the effort that legislation is making to defund and destructure publicly funded institutions that provide hope, information, and access to the American public.
Well, since you've been talking about access, one response has been an effort, as I understand it, called Books Unbanned. Mm-hmm. And in 2002, in the spring, April, the Brooklyn Public Library joined the effort and made, at least on the teen level, banned books accessible through the miracle of the internet. And undoing the banned in Boston legacy, the Boston Public Library joined them, along with the L.A. County Library, the San Diego Public Library, and the Seattle Pacific Library. There's a lot to talk about. Allow me to reintroduce you for a moment. Sam Helmick is the 2025-2026 American Library Association president. They have served on various functions, including the ALA Executive Board, former chair-elect of the Intellectual Freedom Roundtable, and the chair of the Iowa Governor's Commission of Libraries. We're talking about banned or challenged books in this hour. You're listening to We the People right here at WPFW 89.3 FM. Again, thank you for being with us this morning. I have it's the enormity of this subject that's really causing me to slow my roll a little bit and not keep on cranking out numbers. But I mentioned really, really quickly that 2023 seemed to be a recent record-setting year for challenge titles at 4,200 plus books. But 2024, there was a little bit of a downward trend of a little over 2,400 books that were challenged. What does that say about the trending? What does that say about what do you want to remind us to keep in mind about, pardon the expression, but this problem that we're facing?
Right. I appreciate that. From my perspective as a practitioner, it teaches me a few things. The first is that the chilling effect is well and alive in America, because you will self-censor when you worry about being arrested, losing your livelihood, being harassed and doxxed online as a library worker trying to provide information to the public. So I think that there is a chilling effect and folks are preemptively censoring themselves and not buying materials that are clearly popular and wanted by the American public, or they wouldn't be published, right? But then the second piece is, once you've banned thousands of books, the list should eventually get smaller, right? They just keep coming back for more because censorship is a hammer looking for a nail. So I would continue to alert people that the trends are at least twofold. We are going after and erasing some of our most marginalized communities. We are trying to erase any attempt to have critical conversations about race, history, justice, and society that do not meet some sort of status quo in the supermajority of leadership in this nation currently. And then the second is to essentially defund access to spaces where you can find yourself between the pages of the book. More importantly, you can find others that are not like you between the pages of the book, and you can find housing, medical forms, heat and cool, community, recipes, languages. There's nowhere else. Libraries are uniquely positioned in American life to lift us all up and give us all the same access to the stacks. Once that's gone, I think a significant, if it ever disappears, it is a significant foundation to American life and how we have assembled and communicated together. And the dismantling of that will be really the loss of, I think, the Overton window and how we can really reconcile difficult challenges together.
Yeah, the Overton window being the politics of what's possible determined by an elite few.
Yes.
So if we turn that over, we're all going to lose the freedom to read. That's basically my interpretation of what you're saying.
Yes. And if we turn over our freedom to read, they get to decide what the talking points are, because they'll be the only ones afforded the information to inform those talking points.
I'm mindful of something particularly that occurs in our broadcast area, Washington, D.C., and the surrounding area. It seems to me that librarians in practice are very generationally sensitive. They really do care about younger and older people beyond stereotypes as far as how the library can serve them. They seem to facilitate a very open and public, I would even say, intergenerational conversations. What is the relevance or the related point of how librarians and libraries try to engage the reading public? I mean, we all together, we are a book community.
Right. I think it's understanding that shared learning is a transformative experience. I actually fell in love with libraries when we had an insect zoo visiting my library for a summer reading program. And in rural America, summer reading programs are often the summer vacation for the family. And a little person of a completely different age, gender, and race than me walked up and said, "Sam, if you hold the tarantula, I'll pet him." Now, David, there's a couple problems with that, and it's not just because tarantulas are arachnids, not insects. I don't do tarantulas. But do you realize that there's nowhere else in American life where we would have become thought partners and explorers and tackled a fear together and had a transformative experience? I would never have had the luxury of meeting this little person and getting to be brave with them as they just, their shaky hands pet this gross hairy spider and I'm trying not to pass out from fear. And I thought about the fact that whether it's an insect zoo or a cooking class or a book club, neighbors become thought partners and friends in a way that's really nowhere else in society that's possible.
Well, we're approaching the halfway point of our show. Boy, time is really flying here. But let's do this. I'm going to be silly for a moment. What's the present top 10? And you can mix it up with perennial titles that are challenged or attempted to be banned from libraries.
Yeah, so we continue to see things that are popping up from like years and years ago, which suggests that there's just a copy and paste list floating around outside of the...
So beyond William Shakespeare, beyond the Bible, beyond Mark Twain.
Yes, but we definitely have George M. Johnson's All Boys Aren't Blue on there again, Genderqueer, which is a beautiful memoir by Maya Kababe. And then classics, right? So The Bluest Eye by Toni Morrison continues to come up again and again. And then I think about books that I read that were popular when I was in high school 20 years ago, like The Perks of Being a Wallflower by Stephen Chbosky. And these all depict stories and perspectives of folks who are not white, het, and cis. And that's really a pity, because we know that the spectrum of life, the spectrum of American life, the spectrum of beautiful ideas will exist whether we encounter them or not, and these stories deserve their sharing.
If we couldn't extend our imagination, what are the pro and con points of these attempts? What are the, in other words, I'm just asking you, what are the talking points that you commonly, or either you or other librarians, of course, would hear?
Right. So I think it gives us a couple of opportunities to remember that libraries are clearly relevant to American life. And I think sometimes with the age of the internet, we've conflated content with information and information with knowledge. And so reminding folks of that public space that really is required to support learning life throughout the duration of life has been useful to us as we consider our values as Americans. I think that this has provided an opportunity for stories that may have kind of fallen asleep on the shelves through the annals of time to come back and rise up. These are powerful, important stories, and I'm really grateful that these authors' voices are being shared with another generation in a way that may not have happened organically because of the wonderful competition of news stories. Right? And so the fact that my nieces and nephews have bigger exposure to Maya Angelou, Toni Morrison, Richard Wright is incredible to me because the world is distracting us with social media and algorithms, and these stories are essential to understanding the complexities and beauties and, frankly, tragedies of life. And then I think, thirdly, it gives us an opportunity to remind folks that if we can't afford ebooks, if we can't afford books in libraries, if your consumer rights do not have a seat at the table for libraries, then we don't even get to debate the merit of the books. So ebook prices, funding libraries, are intellectual freedom conversations too, and we need folks to visit places like ALA.org/libraries/advocacy, more importantly, so that they can show up for our libraries.
And 2 points before we go to break. Most library systems nowadays offer the ebooks and even audiobooks for free to individuals.
Right. And that's wonderful for access, but libraries are paying higher premiums than the general public.
So it's tax money and other things that are put to use. I mentioned that some of the research over this issue is done by the ALA Office for Intellectual Freedom, which I think started as early as 1967. Can you tell us briefly about that before we get a break, and then I'll return with a more overarching sense of approach?
Right. So First Amendment law, in terms of everything from displays to books to how we assemble in meeting rooms, are important in our public spaces in libraries. So the Office for Intellectual Freedom doesn't card folks at the door, but instead supports them, encourages them, and listens, and offers advice, offers an ear, offers training. And so if you visit the Office for Intellectual Freedom at ALA.org, you can too report concerns, connect with a human person, and learn more about defending your right to read.
Well, listeners, you're listening to We the People right here at WPFW 89.3 FM, your Jazz and Justice radio station, each of 100 programmers, both in terms of music, arts, and culture, but also news and public affairs, tries to empower you, the listener, to help join together and build better communities, a better world, one broadcast at a time. We've come up on a break, and part of our service to you is to provide public service announcements. So if you stick with us, we'll continue our conversation with Sam Helmick regarding banned or challenged books. The problem is still with us. We'll see what more we can find out, but stay tuned after this.
Hey, DC, we are reigniting the spirit of unity in our community beginning Monday, October 13th through Saturday, October 19th, by commemorating the 30th anniversary of the Million Man March and Unifest, two iconic events that shaped our history and continue to inspire our future. Events include prayer calls, a torch run, a lantern peace walk, a recommitment service, and a mini Unifest at Union Temple Baptist Church. This is an opportunity to honor the past and build bridges for a united future for our children and families, reviving the values of the Million Man March and Unifest. Details at UnionTempleDC.com.
And welcome back to We the People. I'm your host, David Whetstone. But I say at this point of the show, the importance is upon our topic, banned or challenged books. It's a problem that's still with us. And more importantly, I ask you to focus on the offerings from our guests. In this case, Sam Helmick, Sam Helmick is the 2025-2026 American Library Association president. Helmick has served as a member on the ALA Executive Board, past president of the Iowa Library Association, and they have previously served as a former chair-elect on the Intellectual Freedom Roundtable and chair of the Iowa's Governor's Commission of Libraries. And again, thank you so much for being with us. So we both were remarking on the changing world, the changing marketplace in which libraries and schools and the book community operates. At least just in passing, what with all this activity about AI going on, artificial intelligence, how has that affected this particular issue?
Right. So I think this particular issue is affected at least in two ways. The first that I can observe is that libraries are meant to support the public. Library workers are meant to encourage and support and connect you with resources. And now we're being asked to fight for the privilege to do so, to advocate on behalf of our library communities in order to keep serving them. That's very fatiguing. And it's really difficult to focus energy almost exclusively there under such a wave of censorship when we know that copyright, artificial intelligence, intelligence engineering is really an essential thing that we need to be equipping the American public to understand in order for us to continue to be viable with academics, with entrepreneurial development, with the economy, and with national security. And so the American Library Association has a special task force right now developing an artificial intelligence policy that should be reviewed by council in June of 2026 that essentially will help our libraries to best equip a couple of factors. A couple that I think of, David, off the top of my head are like the erosion of trust and truth with algorithms and who get to develop those, the bias and suppression that we can create with these tools and trying to figure out how we withstand and course correct for that and to analyze it when we acknowledge it and see it. But then we also have to be careful about censorship and surveillance. The idea of being able to read free is really dependent on the fact that your privacy is paramount. If you can't freely explore information and use educational and informational tools to develop your own philosophies and find your way, then you do not have free and private inquiry. And so protecting us, informing the public on what pieces of legislation should probably be in place now or very soon in order to support that work is important. And then a continual, you know, re-education of what is content versus what is information versus what is knowledge. I think folks thought that with 1984, which is the theme of our week, you know, censorship is from 1984, that we would have a Orwellian dystopia where information would be suppressed. And I would agree to an extent, obviously that's happening, but then there's that Ayn Randian perspective of information or content, moreover, would come in so rapidly that we would devalue its currency and we would not understand or distinguish between them. And so teaching the American public about disinformation, misinformation, and deepfakes is the work that library workers are committed to doing, because not all of us can sit through a 17-week course to deep dive into these things. And frankly, as soon as best practices and standards are established, new ones are developed. So this is the work of the public, and the public has equipped and resourced us to do it. And boy, I'd love to get back to focusing on it.
Well, frankly, that was such a robust answer. My head is spinning. And what I'm thinking of, and I'm trying to imagine as listeners might, you know, we moved from a rested place to now both government and private sources are after all sorts of data. And I don't want to egg anyone on, but it's why not go after? I think of some of the federal appellate judge hearings that have gone on in the past with Congress, and every once in a while someone's library records come up. And of course, there's this typical dialogue of, again, people don't, especially forces of authority don't have rights to invade privacy. You know, one of the almost tragedies, I don't think the whole episode is over, but if a lot of people would go to the library, first of all, to further extend their curiosity and lifelong learning, they would also see the library as a neutral convener of correcting misinformation, trusting somebody who would help them find, if not objective sources, reasonable sources to engage a concern, an issue, a subject. Do you want to reflect a little bit about how that is changing over time? It's not just the issue of banned books, but it seems like there's even a larger social frame or context here.
I was thinking about that because ALA was involved in some of the work right after the Patriot Act was passed, and Section 215 tried to suggest that any tangible things like library records or bookstore records could be recouped. And librarians put their lives and freedoms on the line to stand up for the privacy in my own lifetime of our patrons. And so you think about the fact that in our Library Bill of Rights, it's not only our responsibility as professionals to protect your privacy and safeguard your confidentiality, but to teach you the tools and the importance of doing so. So that work continues in a digital and surveillance age to be important, but more importantly, that educational piece. I had a wonderful conversation with somebody in a Uber yesterday about why libraries are no longer necessary because ChatGPT gets you everything you want. And I thought, oh, we are rapidly forfeiting our privacy and limiting our scope of resources and available information because we are not aware of what is at stake and what wide, beautiful world is available to you in a variety of formats and voices. So that is also one of the many works of the American Library Association and our public in general. And I really appreciate this conversation because I think sometimes in the rapidity of life, we forfeit things that are really integral to our livelihood, our success, our pursuit of happiness without meaning to.
Well, the forfeiture comes in social contract, social contact, and community. I mean, am I being a nerd? What how much more fun could you have by not going to the library, not seeing kids all excited about stuff, not seeing an older person dutifully studying over something, or a student working on a project, or talking to a librarian and finding out something that you just don't know or don't understand, or creating a new interest. All that comes in the physicality, in the tactile reality of libraries.
And David, you're part of it. You're investing in something greater than all of us. I get to do it as a library worker, but as a taxpayer, as a patron, as a person who comes in and uses their voice and participates, you enable something greater than the individual self. Libraries are great platformers of community-driven initiatives, and we have meeting rooms where life is being breathed into our institutions without us hardly even knowing what's going on, because we're really just there to facilitate a space and an opportunity. And so I like to remind folks that libraries are opportunity on cold storage, and it's up to you all to come in and breathe life into them.
Well, again, getting back to false drama here, the immediate threat of banned and challenged books, a number of people that I just described are rising up, young people and stuff, and this is Banned Books Week. Are there different events? Are there different constituencies? Are there different ways that people are approaching this problem?
Across the nation, if you visit bannedbooksweek.org, you can see where there are youth clubs, library events, read-ins, special programs that really talk about the intersections of public libraries and civic life and our First Amendment and how we're all practitioners in it. And then I just love to remind folks that one of the best ways you can advocate for yourself is to get a library card or dust off the dust from the one you have and go use it this week and the week after that. So you can celebrate your right to read this week, and there are wonderful ideas at bannedbooksweek.org, including the culmination of Right to Read Day this Saturday to celebrate our right to read. But you and I can do that every single day of the year.
What's going to go on this coming Saturday?
So libraries around the country are celebrating with music and food and slam poetry and spoken word and just reminding folks that there are different forms of literacy in the way that we engage in them, including, frankly, this exciting onset of podcasts, growth again and resurgence of radio and audiobooks, because it's like a new renaissance. You and I have the opportunity to not only have the printing press and access to written word, but you and I can listen to conversations like this when I'm washing my dishes or driving my bookmobile down the road. And that's incredible. And so celebrating our right to read, our right to listen, our right to speak will have its own just sort of joyful events to shine off the fact that, yes, liberties need to be defended, and the fight, frankly, is fierce because it's not always happening with the best intentions of the community being served by the library in mind. But when we show up for libraries, everybody wins. When we show up for liberties and literacy, everybody wins. So we need to celebrate that freedom to read.
I want to do a strategic reiteration here, and I do promise you we'll do our best to end on positive notes. But is it unreasonable to be concerned about challenged and banned books, thinking that it's going to be a diminution and elimination, or as part of a politic to eliminate libraries altogether? Would somebody say, David, you're just being outrageous here, you're being too far-fetched? What, from you have a better vantage point than I, what we need to take this threat seriously, don't we?
We absolutely do. And I think there are huge implications here. When we have a single institute for the museum and library services created in our country, and there's an executive order to dismantle that, in the information age, one has to wonder what is being accomplished. The second is we have congressionally mandated dollars, which are supposed to go through that institute to our states to support and match state taxes, which creates less burden and greater impact on our tax dollars. Those have not been fully released or released in a systemic easy way. And so you have the concern about checks and balances, the concern about not investing in America and its education and its literacy life. You also have the concern about not meeting agreements from the federal government when state dollars were directed to match them, and now we're putting our states in a bind, our small and rural communities in a bind, because those services don't stop just because the congressionally mandated dollars have not come to the states like they were supposed to. So you have those large-scale implications that are very worrying. The second piece of this, though, I think is that we need to be very careful about what we're willing to accept in public discourse, whether we really believe that people get to categorize things as wrong think, hate speech, inaccessible, or accessible to those who have enough wealth and interest to pursue them outside of the community collection and the community agreement that we all have built this nation upon, that many of our founders deeply invested in terms of libraries. And then I think the last piece of this is, it's going to take all of us doing whatever we can at our level of ability, whether that's visiting your library, attending a program, telling your dentist about legislation that's going to affect his kids reading in school or her kids going to the public library and for summer reading programs and getting their silver cord volunteer hours. It's going to take all of us speaking up and showing up for our libraries. So I really hope that folks will visit ALA.org/advocacy, because we have things for you, whether you have 5 minutes, 5 hours, or 5 days. And we recognize that if we lift you up and you speak for your libraries, not only will our communities be stronger, but our libraries will be too.
It may be finger in the chin quaint, but can you just, things have changed so much. What are the pictures? What are the images? What are the realities of libraries in cities, in rural settings, in multicultural communities? Just give us a present-day picture. And I'm not trying to shame any of our listeners, because people who've listened to the show over time know there's a steady drumbeat about go to the library, find out. But do me the favor, won't you please paint a picture of what's going on with libraries today?
One of my favorite chapters of all time is Susan Orlean's first chapter of the library book, because she talks about the hum and the buzz on the streets in front of the Los Angeles Public Library before it opens for the day. And you have folks commuting for work and folks who are tourists visiting this institution. You have underhoused populations that are going to be utilizing the space for warmth and heat and water. And you have library staff that are equipping the displays and getting the desks ready. And you recognize that this is a microcosm of American life right before any library opens, because they all serve as community anchor institutions, as centers of their community life. And so it's this beautiful scene. But I'm here to also share that libraries provide not only like digital resources, hands-on learning, entrepreneurial development, book recommendations, but also like community conversations that are absolutely vital and useful, but they're in your pocket with digital resources. So if I'm at home in my pajamas at 3 o'clock in the morning and you really need to download a book right now, you need to listen to something because we've all been there, the library is there for you and equipped to support you with your needs. If the library doesn't have something for you, they've developed statewide consortiums and systems that are supported through the Institute for Museum and Library Services to borrow from each other. So we're not only doubling, but tripling and quadrupling those tax dollars, which is probably why for every dollar you put in an American public library, on average, we're finding a 5 to 9 return on investment. And then lastly, libraries need to be where communities organically connect, which is why we have book bikes and pop-ups and partnerships. And like myself, a bookmobile that we take to 31 stops 5 days a week to our community centers, our neighborhood centers, our preschools, our seniors centers, because it's important that the library be where you are so you can connect with resources regardless of where you're at and live.
Allow me to reintroduce you. Listeners, you're listening to We the People right here at your Jazz and Justice radio station for 48 years because we're listeners supported. WPFW 89.3 FM, WPFWFM.org. 100 programmers put their best efforts in trying to build a better world one broadcast at a time. We do that by way of music, jazz, blues, world beat, and folk. But we also do that by news and public affairs as well. I would remind people that on Wednesdays, our East Coast schedule is at 3. Sophie's Parlor, which is presented by one of the oldest women collectives on public broadcasting, presents music and culture by women but for everyone. At 2 o'clock, Zen El Amin joins us with Shewanana concerning Middle Eastern affairs. At 1, colleague Muiza Mutali and James Pope bring you Africa Now. African-descended people are focused upon in terms of politics, history, culture, environment, economics, and then some, not only on the continent but throughout the world, throughout the diaspora. And I would be remiss not to say, don't forget the blues. The Wednesday edition at noontime comes to you by way of Clarence the Blues Man Turner. All that and more, plus on top of that, my thanks and the thanks of programmers and staff that you've caused us to be in existence and thriving for 48 years. Our guest is Sam Helmick. Sam Helmick is the 2025-2026 American Library Association president. And we're talking about banned and or challenged books, the problems that it presents us, but we're going to definitely end off with the opportunities that the challenge, no pun intended, presents to us. You know, so much is said about, gee, ain't it awful, here's a problem that's facing us. Instead of banned or challenging books, what is the future vision that you and other librarians hope to promote in upholding books, of having us realize that there is a sense of empowerment, that they're part of our lives. We are indeed a book community. Let's really do the contrapositive. Let's do the opposite of being fretting and worrying, not to be naive, of yes, worrying about banned books and challenges to them. Let's try to do the human flourishing of what's opposite of that.
I think I can come up with 5. Let's do it. So the first is like, let's support each other. Let's encourage each other to read things that challenge us and change us and that we love. Let's reach out to our library workers, our teacher librarians, and our media specialists and let them know that as community members, they're our librarian, whether we have children in that district, whether we've used the library lately or not, and we're there for each other. I think the second is recognizing that defending liberties has to be something we all commit to, and this fight isn't free. So supporting your local library, supporting your chapter, whether that be your state library association or the American Library Association, visiting places like ilovelibraries.org. Both of my parents are getting a tote bag. I just donated in their name. Don't tell them though. Ha ha ha. So that we can all gather in this work together, because the American Library Association is often the only firewall between pernicious legislation and the library communities we're trying to support. The third thing I think is definitely recognizing that when you use your library card, volunteer for the library, join a board, share your voice, you make all of us stronger. It's not just defense, it's also joyful offense and recognizing that this community is as strong as its people and that our strength is our unique and diversity of perspective. I think the fifth is just recognizing that it is our time in the crucible, it will be hard, and that if you do what you can, you are enough. Hydrate, eat snacks, and recognize that if you do what you can, you are enough. And then lastly, continue to have these conversations, because it is really easy with the world of distraction and the silos of algorithms and the talking points that try to control all of us to not read outside the box, to not connect outside the box, and not to speak outside the box. So please, please make a commitment to not only visiting and supporting your life and literacy and liberties and libraries, but commit to talking to somebody when it might be a little bit tricky or scary, because the more we do this, the stronger our nation is, and the more we all uphold and practice the First Amendment, which was meant to guide our lights through.
My goodness, what a wonderful charge or mandate for us to follow. Again, it's Banned Books Week. We've mentioned the ALA constantly. Again, let's remind, we've got a minute or two still. What are the resources, again, about not only the engagement of the banned books issue, but other things you want us to have? You have plenty of opportunity to remind us of resources.
So the American Library Association encompasses a lot of learning and literacy life. So visiting ALA.org will connect you with the Academic and Research Library Association, the Young Adult and Library Services Association, the Public Library Association, the Association of School Libraries, so that you can understand what knowledge experts and library practitioners are doing deliberately to support you in those spaces. But if you want to get involved as a member of the public and understand more about our 150-year-old institution that has been supporting this nation for 150 years, go to ala.org/advocacy and you will learn more about Show Up for Our Libraries. If you're like, you know what, I'm already doing that good work, but I'd like to support the people who are doing it, make sure that the library workers who are in the cross lines really need to hear some of our support, go and nominate a librarian for a library award. Go visit ilovelibraries.org and make sure that we're recognizing the good work that our folks are doing to support our communities. And then lastly, I think it's important to remind you all that Unite Against Book Bans is one of the largest consortiums of folks pushing back against censorship in this hemisphere. And so you're going to find allies, friends, and tools to be united against book bans, which the majority of Americans are.
Well, thank you, Sam Helmick. Sam Helmick, again, is the 2025-2026 American Library Association president. We've been talking about banned and or challenged books. It's a problem still with us, but as we've tried to demonstrate in this hour, we have plenty of opportunity to enrich our own lives and the lives of others. And I thank you for being with us very much this morning.
It was a joy to connect with you and talk. Thank you.
Oh, you're more than welcome. And I thank you, the listener, for sticking with us for the hour. So my thanks goes to also those people who make it go, the fellow programmers and staff at WPFW, the News and Public Affairs Department at WPFW, and my engineer, Mike Nasella. Grateful for your support of the station for 48 years. We're coming up on a fall pledge drive in another week. Please think of us. And again, it's a pleasure to be with you for this hour. Make it a great day for yourself and for others. And I hope to join you in that effort. Perhaps we'll meet again sometime soon on the radio. Take good care.
Not Kick It outdoor summer movie series presented by Shaolin Jazz is back and is coming to Southeast DC for the first time ever. Enjoy 3 nights of martial arts and action films scored live with hip-hop, soul, and more, mixed by WPFW alum DJ Two Tone Jones. Then on Saturday, October 25th, the series concludes with the screening of I'm Gonna Get You Sucker at the Capitol Hill Boys Club Artist Gallery. Each event begins at 7 p.m. with a guest DJ set, followed by the movie at 8:30 p.m. Blankets and lawn chairs are welcome. For more details, visit shaolinjazz.com. shaolinjazz.com.
Hey, DC, we're reigniting the spirit of unity in our community beginning Monday, October 13th through Saturday, October 19th, by commemorating the 30th anniversary of the Million Man March and Unifest, two iconic events that shaped our history and continue to inspire our future. Events include prayer calls, a torch run, a lantern peace walk, a recommitment service, and a mini Unifest at Union Temple Baptist Church. This is an opportunity to honor the past and build bridges for a united future for our children and families, reviving the values of the Million Man March and Unifest. Details at UnionTempleDC.com.
WPFW is the media sponsor for the Institute for Policy Studies 49th Annual Letelier Moffitt Human Rights Awards on Thursday, October 9th at 5:30 p.m. Unsung human rights heroes will be celebrated in the memory of the victims of the Pinochet dictatorship and fallen colleagues Orlando Letelier and Ronnie Carpin Moffitt. This year's event takes place at the Friends Meeting House of Washington, D.C., and celebrates domestic awardees Detention Watch Network and Jeanette Vizguerra, an international awardee, National Coordinating Roundtable of Organizations of Retirees and Pensioners of the Republic of Argentina, with musical performance by Navasha Dea. That's the 49th Annual Letelier Moffitt Human Rights Awards, 5:30 p.m., Thursday, October 9th, at Friends Meeting House of Washington, D.C., 2111 Decatur Place, Northwest. Details at ips-dc.org/LM49. That's ips-dc.org/LM49. WPFW, your station for jazz and justice, building a better world, one broadcast at a time. WPFW has offered inspiring music, poignant stories, and critical journalism for over 48 years. Whether reminiscing while hearing Nina Simone or learning about the harm done due to gross global inequity, WPFW has been the soundtrack for moments of revelation, joy, sadness, and resistance. It's your generosity that allows us to continue this tradition of expansive, emancipatory excellence in community radio. We ask you to once again be in solidarity with WPFW during our fall pledge drive by donating at WPFWFM.org and additionally from October 12th through the 25th at 800-222-9739. There is only one WPFW and only one you, the listener, who is committed to keeping independent music and message available to the people. Your generosity sustains and challenges us to build a better world, one broadcast at a time.
The DC Palestinian Film and Arts Festival is back this October with powerful Palestinian storytelling through live performance, films, and discussions with artists and activists, a culinary workshop, and a special children's program. The festival kicks off on Thursday, October 9th, and runs through Sunday, October 12th at MLK Library and other venues.